thinking about sustainability, many people are aware of some personal actions we can take, being it to take less flight, to eat more plant-based meals, or to, in general, power less of the consumption. But have we ever examined our wardrobe to see how much our clothing, our day-to-day personal items are having the impact of the environment? Just to put into context, the fashion industry actually count up to 10% of the total greenhouse gas emission every year. And if we are aware that airplanes are bad, we look back, water consumption, the water waste of the fashion industry is the second biggest of the whole sector. So meanwhile, we are aware of all the impact of the industry. There are some companies fighting hard to solve the problem, Trove being one of the companies promoting circular fashion and helping brands to generate resale system to renovate their supply chain to reduce the impact of the fashion ecosystem. And today we have on the show Maddie, who works as in the data team of Trove, and we'll listen to her more in depth about how she is using data to powering the operation of Trove to optimize the step-by-step to improve the operation of the warehouse and manufacturing. And we will dive into more depth about how really is the impact and the pollution from the fashion industry and what is Trove doing in terms of the effort. Welcome to the show, Maddie.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So why don't you introduce more in depth what is really Trove? I'm sure you have a much better definition than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So Trove is, we kind of call ourselves the powerhouse or the workhorse behind circular shopping for our different brand partners. So I'm sure that folks have heard of different resale platforms like ThredUp or Poshmark, where you know, you can buy used clothing or used shoes, whatever it is. Essentially, what we're doing at Trove is trying to take back resale and put it into the hands of our brand partners. So we work with companies like Patagonia, REI, Lululemon, Levi's to create branded resale programs for them so that they can, you know, kind of control their inventory and resell it to their customers and just try to kind of appeal to a larger customer base while also promoting sustainability within their own brands. So, we essentially run all of the operations of these programs and partner directly with our partners to kind of design a program that works best for them. Mm-hmm.
I think when I learned about Trove, one thing that really gave me credibility is your partner profile, how you're really working with very sustainable at core brands like Patagonia and the very big scale companies like Lululemon. And as I understand, you are different from the other upselling fashion company is not, you don't collect all the brands and put them into the one selling outlet. Instead, you help the brand to regenerate their own system. And to what part of the supply chain process do you touch on?
Yes, that's correct. We help them kind of set up their own storefront so that they're able to still maintain their resale programs instead of having someone else kind of manage their, I guess, resale channel for them. And so we touch everything though, from the collection of inventory all the way through to the sale of the inventory. So really when you're interacting with one of the resale programs that are kind of powered by Trove, it feels like you're interacting with say Patagonia or Lululemon, but really we're kind of doing the work behind it. So for example, we have mail-in trade-in programs where folks can take a jacket, a Patagonia jacket that they haven't worn in several years. It's just been sitting in their closet. They can mail that into us. It goes directly to our warehouse in the Bay Area, and they'll receive a gift card in exchange for that jacket. And then we'll do all of the processing for that item. So we'll do kind of the condition assessment, any sort of cleaning or repair that needs to be done on it, photography, and then we'll list it for sale. And then any orders that are placed for the Patagonia program, so Warnwear, we still fulfill those orders. So we're kind of an end-to-end service provider for our brand partners, trying to kind of take the burden off the brands to set up resale programs, because it really is a pretty logistically challenging business to get into. And so we're essentially just trying to make the barrier to entry of creating a branded resale program lower. So we're taking on that burden instead of the brand actually having to do it themselves.
Definitely. And as your job, if I understood correctly, you're working exactly to optimize the operating system. As we all know, the supply chain management for fashion industry is very, very complicated, from the origin of the material, where do you get your cotton from, to how do you ship it, to produce into textile, and then step by step from dyeing, it travels all around the world, and in the end end up in the factory. That's also why the carbon footprint of one piece of clothing is very, very big. Maybe you can explain in a bit detail of every step of the process, what is the impact Trove is making, and what is your effort of intertwining data analytics to maximize your impact?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I'll start out maybe by just kind of going a little bit more into in depth of the process of creating a new item, because I think it's really helpful to understand that context first before understanding where we come in. So, yeah, as you said, when we're creating a new item, so let's take a jacket, for example, again. When we're creating a new item, there's a lot of resources that go into it, from the actual raw material. So raw polyester, or like the raw materials that go in to create polyester. There's the raw cotton, potentially. There's maybe even down feathers that need to go into the jacket. In traditional retail, and I'm emphasizing traditional retail because there are businesses that are, I would say, more responsible or just more sustainably minded, like a Patagonia, when it comes to sourcing their materials. But when we're talking about retail in general, oftentimes those materials are virgin materials. So that's the first time they've been used, the first time they've been extracted from the earth. So essentially, every time that we're trying to create a new item, we're taking something out of the earth to do it. So kind of the first step is extracting those raw materials, spinning them into fibers, actually like assembling the garment, which that step alone has about, I would say, around 15 to 20% of material is lost during the assembly of an item. Wow. So that right there is like a huge point of waste, right?
Is it about the electricity we are using? Is it the transportation, or what is involved? Why is it taking so much percentage?
Yeah, that's truly just the fabric loss. So, So imagine, making this t-shirt. Yeah, just cutting the material out and like cutting it into the right pattern and then sewing it together. We have about 15 to 20% of fabric loss just from that step alone.
Wow. Okay.
It's pretty crazy. And then, there's everything from like dyeing the material, if we have to do that kind of stage, which most items do have to go through that process as well. That's another impact as well. And then, so that's just kind of the first stage of actually like creating the item. And then we have to transport it to the new factory, or to the distributor. And since most of our garments are created overseas, oftentimes in like Asia, especially like Vietnam, or kind of where a lot of our partners create their items, we have to bring the item over to the United States, thousands of miles away, oftentimes via plane or freight is kind of the better option. But that again is like a huge impact. And then of course, like the last step is getting the item to the customer. And so to manufacture a brand new item, we're talking about between, I would say on average, like 8 kilograms of CO2 up to, I don't know, around 15, just obviously depending a lot on like the type of item.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like understanding the new item impact, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pivoting over to resale, I know this is a lot. So jump in if I'm talking too much, but I could go on about this forever. So pivoting now over to resale, the fundamental thing to understand is that the impact of resale boils down to this concept of displacement. And displacement is essentially like, how often is the purchase of a used item replacing the purchase of a new item?
Mm-hmm.
Because if folks are just buying used stuff in addition to their new things,
right,
we're not really doing anything for the environment.
It's just something extra to have.
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. it's actually just contributing to the overconsumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
And contributing to the extra waste and just stuff sitting around that's not actually being used.
Totally.
But as we start to think about items being purchased used instead of new, so, you know, thinking about like used purchases truly displacing new purchases, that means that fewer new items have to be manufactured in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so really the impact of resale comes down to, can we offset the production of new items?
Mm-hmm. And I believe that's where a lot of the upcycling, recycling, mm-hmm. greenwashing comes in, right? Many companies,
exactly.
they create very good new materials from vintage items or reused items, but in the end, instead of replacing a new purchase, they're encouraging, incentivizing more purchase to add more things to people's wardrobe. And in the end,
exactly.
it's not necessarily sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's a hard conversation too for our brand partners, because
mm-hmm.
we obviously want to find this balance of helping them grow their business. Thing though about our partners is that they all are very like sustainability minded, and so they kind of get that tension.
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean in terms of, if we're talking about business, it's a lot about the P&L. If a company like Lululemon or Patagonia is gonna sell reused item instead of a new item, and they're not necessarily increasing their sales, what is the incentive for them? Is there any profit? What is the profit margin like for them, and what is the impact they can make?
So I can't tell you I don't actually know the exact profit per item for our different mm-hmm. partners. It's definitely less than if they were to sell a new item.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of split revenue with our partners, right? So that we're mm-hmm. making money, they're making money. That's the difficult thing, is that in order to truly embrace the sustainability of a resale program, brands do have to kind of be willing to potentially lose part of their mainline business. I think mm-hmm. the great thing about the brands that we work with, though, is that they are creating such high quality items that oftentimes what actually happens for these brands is that they see a growth in their customer base. So
yes,
we're able to open up the Patagonia market, which is a higher price point, and not everyone can afford a, you know, $200 jacket from Patagonia okay. new.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to actually open up who can access Patagonia inventory through this resale channel.
Interesting.
So a lot of our brands have actually seen growth in their customer base, even though we would expect maybe to see it stay the same or potentially even decrease. Because folks are able to now afford a higher quality Patagonia item rather than maybe buying a coat elsewhere that wasn't as well made, isn't going to be as durable, those sorts of things. So really, like, these resale programs are, I guess, best suited for brands that take the creation of new items very seriously and do it in a responsible way, and are creating durable items that will last, because they're able to kind of, I guess, frankly, like take on the competition in a new way and appeal to a larger group of people that wouldn't be buying these higher quality items otherwise.
Totally. And in terms of business model, it's also a way to increase their retention. As you mentioned,
exactly.
they give out cashback or gift card options, so people mm-hmm. naturally go back to purchase again within the same store.
Exactly. And that's kind of the benefit of this branded resale model, as mm-hmm. opposed to, you know, Patagonia inventory being sold on Poshmark is that it Sure. is encouraging this Mm-hmm. like brand loyalty.
Yes. So this is what we talk about displacement. But what about for, I know many Lululemon enthusiastic, they might have 8 pairs of leggings in their wardrobe where they really just have 2 pair of favorite that use 90% of Yeah. the time. Does it necessarily reduce the frequency of purchase for the customers? Because if for people, their goal is to look fashionable, they like to change their style very often. How is the interaction in this sense?
Yeah, so that's kind of where, when we talk about inventory just sitting in your closet that's not being used, mm-hmm. that's kind of where this idea of trade-in becomes very powerful. I think my ideal situation would just be changing consumer mindset and realizing that you don't need to switch leggings every 2 years, you mm-hmm. know, just, I guess, yeah, but that's also like a larger push that needs to happen, right? Is just moving away from this idea of like fast fashion and changing consumer preferences and just accepting more that we have to use the stuff that we have. But I think that that's really where trade-in becomes powerful, because when someone has 8 pairs of leggings just sitting in their closet and they only use 2, they could potentially trade in those other 6 items, get a Lululemon gift card in exchange for those, so that those 6 leggings now are able to find their next home and actually be used the way that they're meant to be. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that person could purchase another pair of Lululemon leggings down the line, like a new pattern or a new like that. So trade-in is really what powers this concept of circularity, of getting supply out of people's closets and back into the supply chain, so that we're able to then produce less and make sure that people are still getting the stuff that they need or want.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And since we're talking about data numbers, why don't we put some number to concretify what does the impact really mean when you're collaborating yeah. with your partners, and how much greenhouse emission can they save, and what is the general impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to that example that I gave earlier about the coat, mm-hmm. we were talking around, you know, a new item can be anywhere from 6 kilograms to 15 kilograms of CO2 to produce. Wow. For a brand like Patagonia, I think I hinted at this earlier, but didn't really finish my thought. For a brand like Patagonia, where they're making stuff with a lot of recycled content, are just being really aware about their manufacturing processes, that new item footprint might be substantially lower. Mm-hmm. When we start to account though for the actual savings, some of the things that we need to think about are, what do we need to do to get the item back into use? So do we have to clean it? Do we have to repair it? How much transportation do we have to put into it to get the item yeah. to the new customer? Like those sorts of things. So there are impacts involved with resale. It's not just mm-hmm. like a, yay, you're saving 8 kilograms of CO2 because we don't have to produce a new item. That's not quite it's not quite that simple. So when we kind of take all of these factors into consideration, our average customer saves right around 50% for a used purchase. It's just under 50%. I think the most recent number is like 49.7%. So that's around 2.9 kilograms of CO2 per item that's sold. When we're talking about, and again, this brings us back to this idea of displacement. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about someone who truly is displacing a new purchase with a used purchase, those savings increase all the way up to about 90%. So really, like, the biggest factor I would say is, when we're talking about savings from resale, is displacement. It all boils down to, are you buying this thing because you want it, or are mm-hmm. you buying this thing because you need it and you would have bought it otherwise? So really, as we drive folks to only buy what they need, mm-hmm. we're going to start seeing an even bigger return from kind of the sustainability perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because you're saving the item, the supply chain from the raw material production and then the waste
exactly.
in the process, everything accumulates to about 90%. That never thought about the number would be that big.
Yeah, because really when we're talking about true displacement, mm-hmm. all that we need to think about is the cleaning impacts, the repair, and the transportation, which compared to creating a new item is like minuscule.
Minimum, yeah.
Yeah.
And then in terms of when you are operating to replace, renew an item, you also generate impact on emission, electricity, transportation. How do you go about measure those and how do you optimize the process with data analytics to your case specifically?
Yeah. Our company is a technology company. So we are based in the Bay Area and so have a huge tech influence. Data powers pretty much everything that we do. And mm-hmm. it's really cool. Our operations team absolutely adores data. Like they're always asking for more. Our warehouse manager in particular, I think that if he could just play around with Looker, our data visualization tool, all mm-hmm. day, he probably would. So it's amazing to see, I guess, all of the decisions that are being made based on data at Drove. But in terms of like how we quantify the actual resale impacts, mm-hmm. We're able to track at the item level when an item is sent out for cleaning or when it's cleaned in-house, the kind of when it's repaired, where it comes from, where it goes. Like we're able to see all of this at the item level.
Okay.
And so basically what we do each year is we work with our cleaning vendor, we work with our energy company to figure out the kind of total emissions from our warehouse footprint or from our cleaning footprint for that year. And then this is overly simplifying it, but just divvy it up across all of the items that were cleaned mm-hmm. or that were stored in our warehouse for the year. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to get this kind of rough estimate of, on a per item basis, how much energy or water had to go into putting that item back into use.
Wow. And is that information accessible for the consumers?
Not yet. That's on our roadmap for the next couple of quarters. Our hope is to make it very visible for the customers that mm-hmm. you know, when you're making a purchase, you're able to see on the site exactly what you're buying and what that mm-hmm. means from a carbon, water, and waste perspective. And really the idea there is that drives us towards that one-to-one displacement. I firmly believe that mm-hmm. like when we give people the knowledge of what their purchase is doing for the world, that people Hopefully. Will make their decision.
Yeah, I truly believe educating the customers is very key. For example, Absolutely. We talk about how one piece of garment can generate about, let's say, 10 kilograms of carbon. But for me personally, it's very hard to size because I don't have anything to refer it to. I don't have this knowledge in my mind, right? So some exposure on that side, I believe it can be really powerful.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And coming back to your operations team, you said the whole team is big fan of Looker, which is data visualization. It's very interesting to see because when we talk about data analytics, people tend to talk about machine learning, artificial intelligence, but sometimes the data can be just simply straight number and using graphs to do storytelling, then to translate data into very actionable, simplified points for the team to take decision upon. And I think Trove is doing exactly that. Do you think you can give a little detailed examples about what specific data and aspects are you tracking and how tracking that helped you to improve the process?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the big things that I've worked on the last couple of months is getting a kind of real-time view of the time and cost to list our inventory. And so what that looks like is being able to track at kind of the warehouse level, how much time is being spent on each part of the process. So on checking items in, doing that condition assessment on photography, on cleaning, like every step of the process, we want to know how much time is being spent on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then because we're able to track, hey, this blue Patagonia t-shirt was photographed on this day by this person,
mm-hmm.
get an idea of how much time was spent photographing that item. And so when we look at that at like the macro level, we start to see that, you know, when we add up the check-in time, the photography time, the cleaning time, et cetera, we're able to get a sense for the total time and therefore the cost, the labor cost that it is to list any given item. Mm-hmm. And we can even start to do comparisons across our different partners, across different categories. So like, do tents take longer to process than t-shirts?
Mm-hmm.
And they do.
Okay.
tents are hard. Tents are just really big. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's really interesting to get to see these kind of trends across different partners and across just the diversity of inventory that we process, mm-hmm. and start to figure out like different areas where we can optimize our operations to essentially just drive better profits, right? That's sure. what it all boils down to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it sounds very simple and straightforward. If you know data, you say, I just measure and then improve and check where I have the most effectiveness and how do we change. But in the end, the progress of generating and being able to track data, I assume is a big effort itself. So how did you initiate the process and how long did it take you to really be able to track each step of the process?
Yeah, it's been an iterative process. Mm-hmm. I've been at Trove for a little over a year and a half. And when I first joined, it was just all about figuring things out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's really been the last 6 months or so that have been much more focused on this project.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's been a totally iterative process, especially on the, we call it time tracking, but on the side of like figuring out how much time each person is spending on any given activity. That especially has been an iterative process with our operations team, mm-hmm. and we're still iterating on it. But there's so many activities that go on in a warehouse, like more than I ever thought possible. And so I think like the first few months, I just had to wrap my head around what all it is that we're doing in our warehouse and figuring out how that shows up in our data. Because of course there's like our engineering team can tell me how it's supposed to show up. But sometimes how it's supposed to show up doesn't perfectly match how it does show up in reality.
Is there a special case you can introduce us?
I guess like anyone that works in technology knows that like engineering and product operate in a very specific way, and they have to go through the, you know, product requirements, the tech specs. Like it's a very standard process that you have to follow in order to introduce new product capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes our operations team needs to move faster than that process will allow.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll just find workarounds for things. And so they'll, for example, we have this concept of like location transitions where we're able to see like this item moves from this place to the other. It's like a pretty common like data structure type or data type of just seeing like changes, right? It's just a change log of locations.
Mm-hmm.
And so like our operations team utilizes those a lot for being able to track like photography throughput and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so figuring out, you know, the operations team implemented this one process that it only exists in the operations team's head.
Yeah,
it's not like a specific product feature, right? So figuring mm-hmm. out then how we actually track that, how we turn that into reporting, and then also how do we maintain that? Because like the operations team, when they create a process, like they're going to iterate on that process, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been a lot of like needing to stay in touch with the operations team to make sure that I understand the changes that they're making mm-hmm. and understand the why behind the changes that they're making so that I can like try to help support them and help them see the impact of those changes mm-hmm. as they make them.
It's definitely not a trivial job to install all mm-hmm. those little tracking process.
Yeah, yeah. And they, like I said, they love it. I mean, it's awesome. It's overwhelming sometimes, but it's awesome because like the more exposure the team has mm-hmm. to data, the more they want it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this amazing process of like learning together and growing together where we're just constantly figuring out like, what else can we do with this, right? Mm-hmm.
Really cool. I think that's an amazing data culture you've curated with the operational team, because many times when you're introducing data to a existing organization, it sometimes hits the blocks because tracking means extra effort to initiate the process and extra effort to sit down and doing analysis, and it's extra criteria for them to meet. But if the whole team is really buying in the idea, in the end, whatever gets measured gets improved, and it's a win-win for the whole team. So it's super cool to see the culture is being curated, and you see the significant impact it's making. Then yeah, how many people are there in the data team in Trove?
On the analytics team, there are 3 of us, and then we also have 2 data scientists, and then 2 data engineers. So we're still fairly small.
But you're starting making impact and potentially growing.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And then I don't know if you have more use cases about how data analytics is helping with the optimization process. If you have more cases to introduce, I'm sure it's very interesting for the audience to learn about.
Yeah. Yeah, so another example that I have is that as many early stage startups, when I first joined, a lot of our operations were driven by Google Sheets, and frankly, still are. And when I first joined, our quality assurance team, our QA team, was tracking everything that they do via Google Sheets. Okay. And the QA manager would, on a weekly basis, go through and run all of her reports based on this Google Sheet. It was super painful, took up way too much time for her, and just took her away from doing the other stuff that she should be doing.
Sounds very familiar.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess also taking a step back, so our QA team is there to ensure that the folks that are checking in our items, so doing the kind of condition assessment and identifying the items, are doing what they're supposed to be doing, are doing it effectively, are maintaining the condition standards, all of that stuff. And so they're mm-hmm. our quality assurance and training team. And so essentially what they do is they'll reassess an item, see if there were any flaws that were missed, make sure that the condition assigned to the item is correct, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And so one project that I've worked on is trying to systematize that QA tracking so that they don't have to do it in a Google Sheet. They don't have to do that really painful reporting every week. And our QA team now they're amazing. We have this report set up for them that mm-hmm. is essentially like guiding them to the folks that need who still need to have their items QA'd that week. So we have like targets for how much or what percentage of items are checked. For each check-in associate, we're able to see kind of the check-in associate's performance that week and see maybe like what types of inventory they're struggling mm-hmm. with so that we can target them for additional training. So for example, like if we see that, hey, like Tammy was struggling with footwear, she kept missing like this one flaw type, we can say, okay, hey, we need to do additional training for you so that we can help you understand better like what foot imprints look like on the soles or something like that. So we're able to get really hyper specific about mm-hmm. how we need to be training our associates and kind of where their areas of specialization might be too. So we're able to kind of point out both their strengths and maybe their weaknesses via this information.
That's a very, very nice example. And is the whole process done through, for example, Looker?
Yeah. Yep, it is. Yeah. So more Google Sheets.
Yes, that's awesome. It's actually a pattern I see because I work mainly with startups and small teams. And when you're doing the transitioning from like to building data culture within the team, you often get in touch with Google Sheet, and your job is to pull the team out of the manual work, even though they think it's automatic enough. But it's like, I can introduce you and connect the data source. Then it's very interesting because your scope of work, not only touching traditional analytics, you also touch on like data engineering and automation. Mm-hmm. And I think these are all very interesting and key components of data. Like being it could be very simple vanilla kind of tool, but in the end it does save human labor and it gives you timely, accurate report and save your headache of manually doing the same thing. So it's very cool. In terms of your current workflow, what is your biggest challenge you're facing and or at least area of learning and improvement for you currently?
I mean, biggest challenge is just the operation team just wants so much more, and they've grown so much, and I just can't keep up. So hopefully we'll be hiring some more folks to help support them.
Because then our audience from the podcast, if anyone is interested in the idea, feel free to reach out.
Absolutely. Check out our careers page. Mm-hmm. We are hiring. So that's the biggest thing right now is just the operations team has grown so much as we've onboarded new partners. Mm-hmm. Like with Lululemon, we've brought on a ton more people.
Yeah.
And just asking more and like better, deeper questions.
Yeah.
It's just
What a good problem.
It really is. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. And in terms of yourself, when you're touching into the area you don't know in terms of data or circularity or impact assessment, how do you educate yourself?
Yeah. I really like to read. I've always been a sustainability nerd, but I didn't know anything about really sustainability in the fashion industry before joining Trove. And so I just read as much as I could about it. And I've been super fortunate that our partners have all been incredible thought leaders for kind of developing out this methodology of reporting on our carbon savings. So I've been really fortunate on that front, but I think that this is it sounds really straightforward to say it this way, but like, just read everything that you can get your hands on or watch YouTube videos, or I can't even tell you the amazing things that I've learned from watching YouTube videos about like DBT is our data transformation tool. Like I didn't have any experience with it, but just reading the documentation and like watching YouTube videos of people using it is how I've learned it.
Yes. That's awesome. Is there any specific channel or book or article source that you would recommend that is your go-to?
Yeah. On the sustainability front, Ellen MacArthur Foundation has some really powerful documentation and research that they've done on circularity in the fashion industry. I highly recommend looking at some of their reports. They are doing fantastic work, and we've been super lucky to get to work with them a bit. On data, I mean, we met through Locally Optimistic. I highly recommend joining that. It's a great channel, a great community. My boss is like big in the Locally Optimistic community. So highly recommend joining that. There's really great events and talks and just kind of connections to be made through that channel.
Yeah, network as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Super. And last but not least, if people are interested in chatting more about your work, about the sustainability, or even to be part of your team, how should they reach out?
Find me on LinkedIn. Yeah,
LinkedIn.
Maddie
Okay.
Eckert, or find me through Trove.
Yeah. We'll add all the links of the above resources or any extra cool. show notes to the podcast so people can have okay. easy access.
Cool. Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me. This was a fun way to start the day.
Awesome. Yes, we bear this time difference. I'm finishing my day and you're starting, but we have this amazing conversation weaving through. And thank you very much for sharing so many details. And it's truly exciting job that you are dedicating your time into, and the impact you're making is very promising, sustainable, and congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so as we are wrapping up this episode, we'll also publish a small announcement. At Data for Future, we are growing our community and the podcast. So we are, with that being said, we are trying to increase our social media presence. We're looking for a social media manager. If you happen to know anyone with your network or yourself being interested in joining the team, feel free to reach out to me as well. And that's it, Data for Future, episode 40. We'll see you next time.